Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So welcome, Paul.
Hello, Paul, and hello, everyone. All our regulars, I hope, are with us, like Paul the Parrot and Rebecca and everyone.
Yeah, well, we've certainly also been having a really busy week on all the corporate reporting, plus the EU-US trade deal. And unknown to all the audience there, Paul has been doing some deep research into strawberries and cream with his squirty cream for lunch, just to get the sugar levels up. So it should be a high-octane discussion this morning.
Well, I haven't got any wine or beer this time, so I've got had to dose up with some natural sugars instead.
Well, until we sort of like start diving into which stocks will benefit from the strawberries and cream rush this afternoon, have you been buying or selling anything at all over
I actually remembered this week for the first time to write down what I've been doing. Yes, I've made some, I've taken one new position. I can't remember if I mentioned it last week or not, but it's a really, really speculative nano cap called Thruvision, THRU. It's been a serial disappointer, terrible company, almost went bust. However, risk reward on it now, it's just refinanced. I think risk reward on it is potentially interesting, because it's been bailed out with a £2.5 million placing, and the market cap post placing is only 5 million. And it's cashed up now for the foreseeable future. Great products, walk through scanners. they are selling into prisons and retail. You know, it's a proper business with proper products. They've just never quite got the sales to the 10 million plus level where it starts to make good money. But they recently announced, I've been buying around a penny, about 1.5p. So it literally is a distressed recent purchase. But I like situations like this where you've got a good product, but they haven't quite managed to achieve the sales that they needed to, but not far off, you know. And they've had a strong Q1. And because of that, the shareholders refinanced it. And I think you could double, triple your money on this. And if it doesn't, if things go well, obviously if things don't go well, it'll go bust. But I'm only renting the shares. I'm going to hold it for about 6 months, give it that sort of window to see if they can turn it around. And if not, just dump them. So quite interesting. Have you looked at Thruvision, Paul?
Yeah. The question I would ask would be, and I've always thought their technology is excellent, and given with sort of the wave of shoplifting and store crime, with people just going into facilities and just picking up anything they want to rather than take it over to the till, you'd think it'd be high demand. So have they got any sort of anchor customers at all that they could sort of like showcase to follow on sales? I mean, I don't know, like Waitrose or John Lewis?
I'm not sure. I mean, one of the backers of it that's repeatedly put money in at much, much higher prices is Pentland. Pentland, which owns JD Sports, of course, which is a huge international group now. So they must presumably like the technology and maybe use it. I think it's mainly used in warehouses. I don't know what the position would be in terms of the general public, because, you know, it would raise privacy issues because you can see through their clothes, you know, and that might not be... but it's apparently got very good AI software because, you know, there's the technology other people use. Have scanners and things, but this in particular has interesting AI video analysis software that highlights, you know, items that people are hiding under their clothes and things. And it has recently been installed in a British prison, and it's been installed in, you know, other sites all over the world. So I just think it's a nice risk reward situation now. It's refinanced, and the market cap at 5 million, is just dirt cheap. This thing was highly profitable. It'd be 50-100 million, wouldn't it?
So
I don't think that's likely. I'm just looking at this as a re-rating trade for some nice contract win type announcements, which they've said are in the pipeline.
What's the difference? Who do they compete against? Is it the other sort of scanner guys? You know, the really big.
There are lots of companies that do scanners, sure. So I haven't gone into that level of detail. I'm not looking at this as a long-term investment. This is just a short to medium-term trade. But I think risk reward, 5 million with it fully refinanced, I think that's attractive.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Definitely. It's one time. I mean, I think the liquidity probably just, you need to size it correct, don't you? I think probably.
Yeah. I mean, I've got my SIP in one of the low cost platforms. So I just bought about 20 tranches of shares, over 2 or 3 weeks. Then I took some in the placing as well, in the retail offer. So you can get in and out of these things not in the sort of size that you go in, but I'm not a minnow, but I'm a sardine perhaps.
Okay. Right, then let's switch subjects. This goes into the housing market and also building products. I know we've talked about it before, but there's lots and lots of different sort of movements of companies, etc. You had Taylor Wimpey this morning, the big house builder, reporting slightly softer and bigger cladding issues. You've also had on the building products, you've had Marshalls had an absolute disaster of a profit warning last week. You had Fortera, the brick boys, going, basically saying they're seeing increasing
shooting
volumes.
Yeah.
And so we've got lots of sort of like crosswinds here, and it's quite difficult to see what's actually going on. I just want, what's your sort of thoughts on it?
I'm totally confused. I have to say, your superb interview with Christopher Mills and his son, really, really enjoyed that. Thanks so much for doing that on Monday. It was brilliant. And he really shocked me, actually, with what he was saying about the house building sector. And they've got a big position in Gleason's, so he knows what he's talking about. And he was talking about all these sort of government and local authority and environmental headwinds hitting the house builders, some of which I wasn't aware of, like a landfill tax apparently is going to go up very substantially. So he mentioned a lot of things. That heat pumps being required to be installed, perhaps, which is another $9,000 cost. So he reckons there's a lot of cost headwinds over and above the ones we already know about for the house builders. So that did rather put me off my bullishness on the house building sector. But then I looked at the valuations, and Wimpy today, it dropped about 5% because of an increase in the cladding provision. And they said something about consumer headwinds, and everybody is saying that we need a couple more interest rate cuts to get the market moving. Foxton said that today in their figures as well. But the Bank of England is saying, apparently, I only read it secondhand from the press, the Bank of England apparently is saying that a housing recovery is now getting established, and they're seeing increased mortgage approvals. It just needs one or two interest rate cuts to stimulate the demand side of it and the affordability side of it. So I don't know. We're just getting all these conflicting factors, aren't we? I mean, Wimpy was all right. The figures today, it's so cheap now as well. Yes. 10% below net tangible asset value. I think it's very tempting to have a nibble on some of these house builders.
Yeah.
Over to you. What's your take?
I think you've got, if you look at the sort of like the whole supply chain, at the sort of the fairly easy, quick fix DIY type retailers, the Wickses of this world, the Tops Tiles, seem to be doing fine. So people are doing stuff that they can turn around quite cheaply and quite quickly in their house. But with Marshalls, with landscaping, which is more discretionary and bigger budget, and you have to sort your garden out and put a garden, I don't know, but put a new office in your garden. That is definitely slow. So anything of sort of like extra substantial cost of RMI is definitely in the hard bucket. And you saw that even through from Fortera this week, because it said it saw growth on its brick volume in new build, but it said, I think the word it used was subdued in RMI. So big spend of RMI seems to be a problem. Short, easy stuff, low, quick cycle. DIY stuff seems to be going okay. Now, in terms of the actual house builders, I think the demand is still reasonable because you're seeing that come through the mortgages. You know, you're seeing your mortgage approvals from there's a couple of banks which have also said they're moving in the right direction. The affordability, the interest rates are going down, or the swap rates are going down. So I think the demand is okay, but as you rightly point out, the cost base with the landfill and with the new, there's basically new costs going on per site. That's going to increase their cost base. So you would then naturally think, if you're a house builder, okay, I can sell the properties, but I'm going to make less margin because my input costs are going up. However, the thing that actually I think will square the circle on the house builders' profit margins will be the cost that they buy the land at. Because that's always the variable, because they basically do a target level of gross margin over a working capital cycle of about 2.5-3 years, buying and selling then the particular site. And then that drives the price that they're prepared to offer for consented or permitted, you know, sort of freehold, which goes in for brownfield or greenfield. So I actually think the people who are going to struggle with who are going to have to offset the cost increase will be the guys who've got the land, who normally got an 8x or 10x multiple when the actual land gets permitted.
That's a really interesting angle on it. I hadn't thought about that. So what you're implying then is that you think the house builder margins could maybe hold up better than the Harwood boys reckon.
Yeah, I think they will. Yeah, because I think the likes of Taylor Wimpey will buy a plot of land to put 200-300, you know, proper houses on it, and will basically mandate that they only buy the land if it basically is this cost. And so I think the actual land prices. The issue you get is that will the net book value of your existing land bank, will that go down as the price of land that you buy also falls? And the answer to that is probably.
Yeah, interesting. And I think also they make much greater use these days of options, don't they? Call options to buy land, you know, at a certain point in time without having to pay much cash up front. So that might help them as well. So, yeah, I mean, they've got to be tempting these house builders at the current levels. But, you know, you can never imagine what the government could do next to screw things up even further.
I haven't got much confidence in those guys down in Westminster.
What a bunch of amateurs. I mean, you know, I accept that every now and again you have to have a sort of Labour government to free things up, you know, to get things with maybe a little bit less capitalism and help the people and everything. But what terrible timing to do it right now.
No, I know. No, I totally agree. Okay, if anybody wants to ask Paul any questions, please put them into the chat box and I'll read them out. We've got one from Letizia09 about the deal of the week, which was Card Factory's purchase of Funky Pigeon, which is the online car DIY. Do you want to take us through your thoughts on this one? Because it did seem to now they've brought their normal store card and gifting service with an online presence with Funky Pigeon, the number two behind Moonpig. What was your thoughts?
Oh, I'm absolutely thrilled with this. I think it was such a good deal. And I do hold this share personally. I wish I could buy more, but I haven't got any available margin, unfortunately. But I did buy some for my friend, my retired friends who foolishly entrust the running of their ISA to me. So I've bought some more of these today for them. I think this is such a good deal because the issue with Card Factory is, as you know, the shares are dirt cheap. I mean, you're on a PE of 5.5, you're on a 6% dividend yield. Balance sheet's not the best, but it's okay. It's been repaired from the problems. Lovely cash generative business, absolutely dirt cheap. Why is it dirt cheap? I don't know. There just seems to be, if you remember, there was a big selling overhang, wasn't there, for a long time. But they cleared, the shares shot up, but have now sort of drifted back down, or some of the way back down. So I don't know why anyone would be selling this when the numbers are really quite good. They put out I suppose you could call it a very slight H1 profit warning, but that's because they brought forward some IT spending. So that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. And they slipped out with this Funky Pigeon acquisition, but a trading update saying in line for the full financial year. It's an unusual January year end. So the current year is January 2026. But anyway, the Funky Pigeon deal, I think, is brilliant, because the whole point, the problem with Card Factory, I think, was that everybody said, oh, they've missed the boat on online. You know, Moonpig have, you know, become the dominant online cards and gifts enterprise. Card Factory does have a its own online offering, but it's kind of buried on the website. You don't even know it's there. Anyway, bottom line, I'll speed this up. They've bought Funky Pigeon, which is the number two, I think. They've only paid 24 million, I think, for it.
26, I think, was the EV on it.
Oh, it was 26, yeah. So yeah, it must have had, fair enough, near enough. So it's 5x EBITDA, which, you know, is a very attractive multiple, I think you'd agree. Plus, yeah, they reckon they can double EBITDA from all the cost synergies, which, given that Card Factory is vertically integrated, that's entirely credible. So they basically bought this thing on 2.5x future EBITDA, and vaulted straight into the number two place in this lucrative market. I think it's a fabulous deal. And the shares should be, I think, are worth £2.
Yeah, I mean, why? How can they bought it for such a good price? Were they the only buyer in town? Because I mean, I don't know what the multiple is. I'd like to check it, but I can't at the moment. It would be Moonpig on their EBITDA. But 5x EBITDA, or 5.2x EBITDA for Funky Pigeon, which is the number two player, is absolutely just outstanding.
Good, I mean, it is outstanding. I mean, a Moonpig is actually looking quite reasonably attractive. It's come, the earnings have improved, and it's grown into its valuation. It's only on about 13x at the moment. So I think PE, so that would probably be an EBITDA of about 10, wouldn't it? 9 or 10 or something like that. But very, very good margins. Moonpig's a nice business. But the fact that, as you say, Card Factory has now bought the number two at an absolute knockdown price. I suppose maybe because anyone else buying Funky Pigeon wouldn't necessarily have all the infrastructure and the card manufacturing side of things that Card Factory's got. So it's probably worth a lot more to Card Factory than to just some other speculative buyer. And it was, the seller was WH Smith, wasn't it? So presumably because they're exiting the high street and various, just focusing on travel sites, Card Factory might have been the only credible buyer, possibly. But it's, I think this is a cracking deal, and this could just be the catalyst needed to re-rate Card Factory shares, because people will look at it now and say, ah, right, they're doing online seriously now, and we know that's lucrative. Therefore, we don't have to rate this thing on 5.5x earnings. We can push it up to 9 or 10x, which is hardly a king's ransom, is it? So
no, it looks like the steal of the day, basically. I mean, just a fantastic.
I can't get my head around the numbers. Yeah,
I know. Being a skeptic, if I was putting my Mr. Suspicious on it, I think, didn't I read in the RNS the figures that they actually got from Funky Pigeon were an average over 2 years to get.
That's right. Yes,
and so you might find the latest year EBITDA is lower than the previous year EBITDA.
You could be right, Paul, but the way I read it, I only skim read it, I took it as saying that the figures were similar both years. But I'll double check that later. That's a good point. Good question for us to check out. And it's done within their existing bank facilities as well. And I think they said it would be earnings accretive from the first full year of ownership, which would be January 27, which sounds way in the future. But of course, it's not. That is starting in February 26. So that's only 6 months ahead, isn't it, that financial year begins. Although I would kind of want them actually to recycle all the cash flow into really expanding it through heavy marketing, because, that jingle, both the Moonpig one. I won't do them, because if I do them, the listeners won't be able to get that song out of their head for the rest of the day. Yeah. But both of the jingles for Moonpig and Funky Pigeon are really memorable. And, you know, that sunk advertising cost on the jingles and the ads, I think, is still very valuable, actually. So I think they've got an absolute bargain. I'm really bullish on this.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, when you look at the actual, just the optics, Card Factory trades on 6.5x PE, pays a 5% dividend yield, and it just bought a fantastic earnings enhancing and value accretive acquisition. So,
with no dilution.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move sectors. We've got a number of people asking in the media sector about the shocking announcement the other day of from STV, the Scottish TV media company that was suffering from very subdued or reduced advertising revenues for its linear television, and also less commissions for its unscripted TV programs. I think its scripted one was doing okay, but overall they made a big drop on their profit forecast, and it's whether there's any read across as well over to ITV. What's your thoughts on STV first of all?
Well, ITV put out good H1 results and the market took its shares up about 10% on the day. So, no, I don't think there appears to be any read across. This was on Monday, wasn't it? 28th of July.
Yeah.
Just been searching for it. It was a big shocker because I think it was in May or thereabouts, quite recently, where they STV had said we're trading in line, you know, everything's all right, basically. But the brokers, it was a big profit warning as well, this was. Pertaining to is it a calendar year? I think it is, isn't it? It's very, very small. It's only 66 million market cap. STV, obviously the preeminent Scottish TV broadcasting business. So we looked at it, and the shares dropped about 25% on the day, down to £1.45. Do you know, have they bounced at all, Paul? Or
they're 128 at the moment.
128. What did I say? 140. Oh, they're carried on going down then.
They're down another 5% today so far.
We couldn't make the numbers stack up. My colleague, I think it was Dave, did a review of it in our report on Monday. Oh no, it was me. I wrote the report. I don't remember that. it's coming back. It's coming through the fog. The broker forecasts were really bad. It was a 45% reduction in EPS for the current financial year ending December. So that, you know, and to be doing that halfway through the year, it's a big miss. And then you've got the obvious follow-on reductions, a 36% reduction in next year's EPS. Now, the problem, I think, is really everything with STV now, because I don't think the dividends are affordable now after this.
Yep.
I think they're going to have to cut the dividends, possibly even cancel them, because the current broker forecasts leave the big dividends in there, but then show net debt zooming up, which I don't think they can afford because they've already got too much net debt, 30 million, which is about half the market cap. And the elephant in the room is the pension scheme. That's draining £10 million a year in cash flow out of the business until 2030, which is colossal for the size of company. Now, you know, I suppose bulls are probably hoping that there'll be a three-year revaluation that reduces that. But, you know, it's got a nasty balance sheet. It's got dividends that now look under serious threat. I wouldn't bank on any dividends in future. And it's got this humongous cash-hungry pension fund. So I've actually turned negative on it. We were never particularly keen on it in the first place. But I think it has to trade well to service the debt and the divvies and the pension scheme. I don't think it can do that now. So, no, I'm negative on STV, more or less at any price, to be honest.
Yeah. Would you think that ITV might buy them at all?
Oh, I don't know. Do you think that would come into competition?
I doubt it, because they're in different areas.
Yeah. I don't know, is the honest answer. I don't know what the shareholding structure is on STV. Does it have any sort of blocking shareholders? I don't know.
I don't believe so. It just seems a total, you know, natural fit, really, because it's basically a shrinking linear television advertising market. They're both playing at different sides, and you know, geographical territories. It just makes total sense for them to come together and leverage and consolidate the market.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I've just looked up the shareholders. Oh, Slater's are in it. Slater Investments. They've got 18%. So they won't be very happy. Then you've got Harwood are in it as well, 6.3%. Quite surprised at that. It's like a roll call of all the main institutions here: M&G, Aberforth, Janus, Schroders, Lombard Odier. They're all in it. Unicorn, Royal Asset. Yeah. So, somebody could make about 5 or 6 phone calls and get about half the shareholder register on side. So, yeah, I would say, half the company owned by the top 6 companies. So, yeah, I would say this could definitely be a takeover target. I hadn't thought of that, Paul. So maybe people will get a nice outcome in the end. Who knows?
Well, the thing is, they've got the value in that business is their license to be a broadcast television company in Scotland, because I think they're the number one after the terrestrial telly. And those licenses, it's like having, basically, if you're a mobile operator and you've bought Spectrum, but you've got with your TV and radio, you have Spectrum in a different area. And so that it actually does get, it is worth something, to say the least. And they do have some decent, but you're right. They've had a bit of a shocker. And I think they probably are a sitting duck for the likes of ITV, who should be owning them, or even Channel 4. I don't know.
But would a larger player want to take on all the liabilities? That's the other question, isn't it?
Good point. With the pension deficit.
Yeah, and it's split into two divisions in the same way that ITV is. So STV has a studios division and a sort of advertising or linear TV division. So I don't know. That's an interesting angle on it, though, Paul. Yeah, thanks for flagging that.
Okay, right. We've got another profit warning of the day, but this time it was today, I think. Is we have Temperance Mystery is asking about FDM, which I think are the IT sort of mounted support. Basically, they train up new graduates from university to become technical, sort of like software implementers and digitization. Then they help companies and the public sector around the world to do their digitization project to implement IT. Their shares are down 35% today as they came out with a pretty tough trading environment. What was your take on their performance?
Well, we've had four profit warnings today, haven't we? So I was going to nickname it Wobbly Wednesday. I shouldn't laugh because people have lost money. But no, this was not entirely unexpected, I would say, with FDM. I mean, this has now lost 90%. Of its share price over the last, I think, 4 years. So the obvious question you've got to ask, which I put into my report today, because we cover everything, or nearly everything, in my Substack, it down 31%. Yeah, that was at lunchtime. Is this just cyclicality, or is the business model broken?
Yeah,
that's the question. I don't know. It's the second profit warning this year. What I would say on the positive side with FDM, it's got a very nice balance sheet with net cash. It's got about 35 million net cash. So that is going to be quite a good chunk, 20 or 30% of the market cap now, isn't it? The reduced market cap. So it's very strongly cash backed now. Brokers have really slashed the forecasts by 34%. So yeah, share price down a similar percentage, but they've cut, this is Shore Capital, it's cut next year's calendar year 2026 forecast by half, down to 9.9p. So really, you could argue, well, put it on a PE of about 10 or 12 and add the cash on, and £1.35 might be about the right price if that's the new normal level of earnings. But if it gets back anywhere near to the sort of earnings it made in prior years, then this could be a multi-bagger from these levels. So getting into interesting territory, I think, interesting value territory. But you probably know more about how the AI... Do you think this is all AI starting to affect them and stuff like that?
I don't know. I get it on the valuation side with the asset backing and the margins. But their brand is known for basically training up these mounties, the grads, and then putting sort of like newly qualified IT professionals into businesses to do low level sort of like software upgrades, hardware upgrades, and all this sort of stuff. But we're not talking major consultants with 10 years experience here. We're talking people newly out of university who are 1 to 3 years experience typically. Okay. Yes. Now, we do know from generative AI that sector, the new jobs and new entry positions from university are being wiped out by...
Oh, that's interesting.
Particularly in the technology sector. There's a real... there aren't as many openings, hardly any openings, actually, for software engineers. If anything, big companies like Google and Microsoft are recruiting people at the top end. They want really good, experienced software engineers because GitHub and these other generative AI are doing all the software programming at the low level. So they don't need that. And if you've used, you know, basically generative AI, you can just do fabulous things, which graduates are just, that's where their training ground is. And, you know, basically, you know, normally coming out of college, and because their brand is associated with largely lower level IT consultancy and digitization projects, if I was a skeptic, I would say they've got to rethink their business model here, because they need to go further up the food chain, incorporate. If they could incorporate the generative AI, which the corporates have got, and then effectively supercharge the Mounties, they're newly qualified, to give them far more ability to be able to do higher value work, which is certainly possible, but it's a different brand, because they're going to go into then the bigger consultancies of like the, you know, the accountants and Accenture and IBM and people like that. But that's reskilling and going up the value chain. I think this lower level IT consultancy is seriously in danger of being AI'd out, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. That all sounds extremely sensible to me, Paul. I mean, it is owner managed as well.
Yeah.
So you couldn't ask for more highly motivated owner managers at FDM. You know, they've been highly successful in the past at spotting niches and developing those niches. So, yeah, I think this for value players who, you know, want to have a punt, I wouldn't sort of try to dissuade anyone from FDM at this current bombed out valuation, given that it's so strongly cash backed as well. They've also got a very flexible cost base. They mentioned today that they're just stripping out layers of costs. So they can actually, it's not one of these things where you've got to worry about operational gearing in reverse. The most of the costs are variable costs that they can just strip out and flex according to the market. So that should protect profit margins, even if the actual amount of the profit is obviously much lower. So potentially interesting, this one.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a comment from Paul the parrot. He's saying he's on his balcony in Tenerife with a beer in his hand. So he says cheers to you there, Paul.
yes, cheers with my cup of tea.
Okay, and then we've got a question from AMPC18. He's asking about IPF, which came out, that's the International Personal Finance Group. They got a bid from, was it Private Equity Day? I think they are a doorstop.
That was today, wasn't it? Yeah.
They're basically a doorstep lender into Mexico and Eastern Europe, places like Poland and Czechoslovakia. I think it's about net assets, looking at their price, about 220 per share. Don't know if you got any quick thoughts on that one, whether you think it's going to go through and whether it's a good price.
I didn't analyze the results. The H1 results came out today, and they say trading was ahead of plan, was the words they used. So it seems to be doing all right. But yeah, the big news, as you say, is that an American finance company called BasePoint is in, quote, advanced discussions with them about a cash offer at £2.20. Doesn't seem a particularly high premium, was it? I think that was a 25% premium. Not madly exciting. And investors get to keep a 3.8 pence dividend as well. So that's another 2% on top. Now, the board have said they would recommend it if it moves from discussions to a recommended offer. So it sounds like it's going to go through, doesn't it? But it depends whether I don't know what the shareholding structure is at IPF, but if most of the institutions are normally happy to just grab a liquidity event, aren't they? Even if the premium is a little bit light, as it looks in this case.
It's a 10% premium on net tangible assets, not a premium. Okay. It's not too premium. Bad. Not a premium to book, but a premium to net tangible assets are about £2 per share. I think they're offering 220 plus the div. So
yeah, you know, so 10% premium to net tangible asset value. Yeah, probably fair, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move sectors. Let's go to oil and gas and marine. We've got SE81. He's asking about James Fisher, which basically does marine services for energy offshore and for decommissioning, plus a bit of defense. I think it's got a bit, according to Richard Staveley for Rockwell, they've got a bit of James Bond technology in their defense, which is doing quite well. Just the normal marine sector, I think it is. But anyway, what's your thoughts? It's a bit of a turnaround, I think, by a guy, the CEO, that is well thought of.
Yeah, I can't find my notes on it. Was it yesterday this reported? It was recent, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I can't remember either.
I haven't put the tickers into my report, so yeah, I always forget.
It's FSJ is the ticker.
Yeah, I know. I didn't put them into the article though, so I forgot. I'm just scrolling down to see if I can find it. I think it was yesterday. We like this. Basically, we think it's doesn't look. Yeah, I found it here. This was yesterday. FSJ. It rose 4% on a H1 trading update. Adjusted operating profit up 14%. So that's quite good. Key market conditions, quote, largely supportive. Okay. And it's achieving margin improvement. So it seems to be, because I think your discussions with fund managers focused on the fact that this has been a really underperforming group over many years, but it's got some really interesting product innovation in it. And management, is it new management here who are trying to improve margins?
Well, I think the CEO's been for a couple of years, but he's got a track record of turning around businesses, and I think his aim is to get it into double digit profitability, you know, margins. Yeah. Currently about 6%.
A lot of it's marine related, isn't it?
Yeah.
Defense related. So we could see this. I mean, we're just guessing really, but if they can engineer a convincing turnaround with higher margins and things, then this thing could be quite good. It said for the current financial year, which is calendar 25, it said no change to expectations. Mm. And we got no broker coverage as well, which is a nuisance. The debt is a little bit high. It's 1.7 times, which is a bit much for us. But the balance sheet overall is okay. And apparently they've done a lot of front-loaded capex. So if they can then generate a return on that, then I think we can hopefully see it de-gear a bit. So we think it looks interesting. No dividends, though. But that's fine as it's de-gearing. So potentially interesting. Are you keen on Fisher, Paul?
I don't know. I'd have to look at it on a sum of the parts, because I think you need probably to separate the different. I don't know whether it's, you know, the technology is applicable across all the relevant divisions, but I'm sure this is a sum of the parts discussion, because when you look at it optically, they're still on to you know, 20 times PE
with
a bit of debt. So they're not massively cheap, which is about, but hey, you know, if they can engineer and improve the margins, then that PE, you know, drops significantly, goes down to about 12. On a 10%. So I think it's a show me story. It is oil and gas isn't something I would naturally go into, because it's the problem I find with the oil and gas sector is if you're a supplier into it, particularly into the big producers or the major tier one, you know, oil and gas services guys, the Halliburtons, the Schlumbergers, and the, I can't remember what the third one is, but there's another one. If you put on to that, the cash flows are terrible, because you end up paying, you're only getting paid like after 90 days. The working capital can be appalling. You know, they don't pay up front on these things. They pay like half a year late, you know, particularly in places like the Middle East anyway. So it isn't a sector I jump into.
Mm, that's probably why Hunting maintains such a massively strong balance sheet. I just remembered, Paul, earlier I rambled off the point and I didn't tell you what things I've been buying and selling.
Oh, okay. You mentioned you'd bought True Vision.
Oh, that was it. So True Vision was my main purchase. I've done three sales as well.
Okay,
I've decided to take a little bit of risk off the table. So I sold today my Kooth, K-O-O.
Oh, yes, let's go through Kooth, because they came out with a trading update, didn't they, which was talking about everything seemed to be on plan, but their cash went down, I think, was the, and then because they've been spending a lot of marketing on promoting that big contract they have in for mental health services in California, haven't they?
Yeah, I unfortunately put something out on my Substack yesterday morning in our article before 8 a.m. saying, oh, this doesn't look very good. I'm a bit disappointed, but mainly because of the cash dropping quite sharply. Mm. Part of that was due to a buyback, but it shouldn't be burning cash. That wasn't the plan at all. And it was a terribly worded update, vague and muddled. It was just awful. So I said in yesterday's report, oh, I think I've missed the boat now. You know, it's dropped 10 or 15%. So, but I slept on it. And this morning then just thought, do you know what? I'm going to chuck it out. I don't want to worry about it. So that's gone. It was only a small position. I exited around break even. So
on that big contract, the reason for the cash was because they've been having to build up. I don't think they'd been properly marketing the benefits of the contract across the whole of California for their mental health services. So I think they've like doubled the number of people who are using the service in the last quarter. And now they're about 130,000. And that's the reason for the marketing, is just to tell everybody, it's a one-off cost to tell everybody across the state that if you need some mental health support, particularly if you're a young child or a young adult, et cetera, then you can go to them. Because I think what would happen if they hadn't promoted it and they hadn't got usages, then that would really put them under the, behind the eight ball. To get it renewed. So I think it isn't something they're going to continually have to do, but they need to get more people using the services, which is why they push the button on the cost.
Well, that's interesting. But you see, that wasn't properly explained in yesterday's update. It was an absolute mess. Whoever wrote it needs to be reallocated to other duties. Honestly, it was a terrible muddle. But it also, I mean, what you've just said indicates that these contracts are not as profitable as we thought, if they have to spend big on marketing But they did reiterate a report that came out previously that they flagged a few weeks ago, saying that the take-up of the service and the usage, California seems to be very happy with that. But I mean, the way I look at it is, Paul, I can always buy back.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm not anti-Cuth. I just want one less thing to worry about, really. And then I've sold out of Zotefoams today.
ZTF. Oh, wow. That is a big news, that is.
Well, it's not because I've lost faith in the company. It's just because I was on margin call. I've had four or five hits from quite a few things lately, like Greg's. I took a small hit on that. Churchill China. You know, I've been probably like most of the listeners. I've been just had small multiple setbacks. Yeah. You know, which you given tough macro, you've got to expect that. Yeah. So yeah, I was on margin call. So I thought, let's just prune a few things where I don't quite have the conviction, because I'm looking at all these profit warnings, four of them today alone, and thinking, well, let's go through every item in my portfolio. Could something happen here that would knock it for 20 or 30%? And with Zotefoams, I think there's a possibility you could get disruption because of the supply chains, the Nike supply chains in Vietnam or whatever. So I just think for the time being, I think it's a great company and I want to hold it long term. But just for the short term, I'd rather be out of Zotefoams just in case something.
You've sent the shares down 2% this morning, Paul.
Oh, I don't think that was me. I only had a tiny position. But the other one
I'll just like to highlight to investors, that is really, really good sort of advice for everybody. When there's things happening in the world, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's higher interest rates, whether it's the profit warnings, difficult trading circumstances, tariffs, whatever, to go through religiously your whole portfolio at least sort of once every few months to see whether things will survive and whether you've still got the thesis. And you know, what Paul did is absolutely the right thing to do in terms of, you know, where he has any doubt, then take it, put the cash and then reallocate.
Yeah.
Sorry.
What could go wrong? No, that's absolutely right. I just look at, I've got about 50 odd positions at the moment. I look at them all and say, well, what could go wrong? You know, look at all the profit warnings we've had this year, loads of them. And is there any recurring theme or we're seeing Forex losses, loads of companies. And they all adjust it out, but it's still a loss, you know.
What was your third one you sold?
Oh, I've top sliced a quarter of my position in Seeing Machines. Okay. So I've only sold a quarter of them because, again, the automotive industry that it relies on is notoriously lumpy and delays. Not surprising if you're launching a new car, you know, you've got 10 to 30,000 individual components from all sorts of suppliers all over the world coming together, and you've got to make it all work. And so things inevitably go wrong. And Seeing Machines has had a lumpy, uneven royalties because of that. So I just felt I bought them around 2p, sold them this morning at 2.8p. So it was a nice trade, but I've only sold a quarter of them. I just wanted to, again, look at the total position size, which for Seeing Machines for me was about 25 grand's worth or something. And I thought, okay, how much would it cost if it hits a nasty bump in the road? And I work on the basis of 30%. So that would be a £7,500 hit, which I know these are not big numbers, but it's, you know, you wouldn't throw away £7,500, would you, willy-nilly? So I thought, well, if I trim it down so that a profit warning, a bad profit warning, might cost me, say, £5,000, then I'm a bit more comfortable. Obviously, I don't want it to happen, but spread over lots of positions. In tough macro, you can't avoid profit warnings. You know, I accept that I am going to get hit by some profit warnings this year, and that's why I'm only buying things if they're cheap.
No, I totally agree. Okay, just on that same theme of unfortunate profit warnings, we've got Andy 2205. He's asking about Somero that is it screening machines that
laser-guided concrete screening machines
out in the States, but they came out with a really big profit downgrade, I believe, and sales downgrade.
That's right. That was another one that warned on profit today. So I put up a section on it at about 5 or 10 to 8. My initial estimate was probably hit the share price by 20 to 30%. But have you got the cut? I don't think it was quite as bad as that, which is...
Yeah, it's down 14% at the moment.
40. Well, that's not too bad, I think, because the earnings forecasts, were dropped significantly. But this is another company that does have quite good variable costs. And it's been very... it's not the first profit warning. It's had several of them. I thought the reasons it gave were actually quite reasonable, because it did say, look, it's almost entirely an American business. It said these are down 15% at the moment, isn't it? £1.90. You got lovely asset backing, strong net cash. So when things don't drop that much on a profit warning, you know they're probably near the bottom, aren't they? It's a very nice business. It's just macro factors out in America. So I think the reasons for the profit warning were perfectly reasonable. And I think it'll recover. So, I'm still moderately positive on this, actually, taking a medium and long-term view. It's a really good business, I think. So, but obviously another setback for long-suffering shareholders. I think they dropped the broker forecast by about a quarter, didn't they, for current year profit?
They're only 12. I mean, even on those reduced numbers, I got it around about 12.5 times PE.
Yeah, that's right. With cyclical upside potential and with plenty of net cash. I mean, the net cash is now going to be about 15-20% of the market cap. So, I mean, there's no doubt it's good value. So the only question listeners need to really ask themselves, is this just macro cyclical stuff, in which case the shares are probably a buy, or is there something underlying going on which is more serious? And that's really what... investors have just got to find out for yourselves. I mean, I don't know the answer on that, but I suspect probably mostly cyclical, because Somero is the clear market leader in that market, apparently.
Yeah, I would say it's almost certainly, because I think their major cyclical, because their main exposure is the States. And we've heard from other capital goods companies, people like MPAC, for instance, is that big manufacturers have not been pushing the button on new production lines, new facilities yet, because frankly, they don't know where to put it anywhere in the world. Now that we're getting sort of more stability and more visibility over tariffs, you get the likes of AstraZeneca, you're getting Roche, who are also announcing big £50 billion investments across into the States. I think you will get, you know, this cyclical recovery in an onshoring of manufacturing. It just is when the companies and the treasurers and the finance directors get comfortable about, does the economics work? And because they don't put a factory up for 2 years or 3 years for Trump. They'll basically want it there for 10, 15 years. So they want to be pretty certain that it's all going to work under all circumstances. So cyclicality, I think you're exactly right. I would say, you know,
it's disruption as well as cyclicality, isn't it? As you've implied, because of all this stuff Trump's doing, a lot of big CapEx projects have just been on hold. So this is a credible situation. I've worked out, converted the dollars into sterling. The old forecast for the calendar 2025 was 20p earnings. The new forecast is 13.8. So put that on a PE of 10, which could be bottom, could be bottom of the cycle earnings even, and add on a bit for cash. You know, really, you should have a floor around £1.70, £1.80. So not much further downside, I would suggest.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. We've got Neil. He's asking about another sort of engineering industrial company. It's actually came out with a profit upgrade or certainly a big increase in its dividends. It was Goodwin, the engineer. I know we've covered this one before, but it does sort of quite specialised engineering services. And I think it's seen some growth in defence and also in nuclear with its it's got these large sort of like skip type storage boxes for Sellafield. But the shares are up 9% for an engineering business, that, and they've recovered really strongly over the last couple of years.
Yeah, this has got a fanatical private shareholder base. It's a very tightly held company. Yeah, Goodwin. We like it. We've been amber green on it for a while. We always say the same thing, basically. We say it's a great company, but it's expensive. And that was what we wrote about it today. My colleague Dave wrote about it. He said the forward PE is 26 times, but I think they've got the bulls on the stock always say it's got this massive, you know, framework order book for nuclear that goes years and years into the future. It's sort of reinvented itself, hasn't it, over the last few years, Goodwin has, going into new markets, and it seems to be just a real class act, I think. It was H1 results out today, only in line, no material tariff impact, so that's good. Sales to China benefiting from increased US-China tariffs, apparently. Although there was news today.
How does that work?
I don't know. I didn't write that section, so I'm just reading what Dave wrote. Very modest net debt, nice strong balance sheet. So decent margins, a consistent performer. We think Goodwin is very good. So the only question is, how much are you prepared to pay for it? And that's a question each individual investor has to weigh up, doesn't it? Because you do have to pay up for quality businesses, don't you?
Yeah, you do, yeah. It's on 27 times PE, doesn't it, going forward? You're right, it's not cheap. But I guess actually that tariffing into China, the way I imagine that works is its main competitors are America. And if they're American and they're supplying into China, then with those really high tariffs they did, like 300% or whatever it was, that stupid thing at the start, then I guess what it means is that there's some of the Chinese, you know, customers now looking for cheaper, you know, parts of supply, and the UK fits that bill with Goodwin. So if that is the case, yeah, I could understand why actually they're overseas. Certainly their Asia Pac sales are doing well.
Well, that's a very rare thing, isn't it? A British manufacturing company selling things to China.
Yeah. No, exactly.
I suppose they might also benefit from the UK's preferential tariff for selling into America as well, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, good. We've got Mr. and Mrs. Greensprout. They're congratulating on your new glasses there.
Thank you. Yes. I've got loads of them. I've got four pairs. So these are the reading glasses. And I'll put on my, I've got a bigger pair of glasses here to make me look even more intelligent. So there we are. These are distance. Oh no, you've all gone blurred. Let's go back to the smaller glasses. So yeah, thank you very much, Mr. and Mrs. Greensprouts. Yes.
Okay. Right.
Specsavers, and I mystery shopped Greg's yesterday as well, which is opposite Specsavers. So had a lovely pasty from them.
Just on Greg's, let's just go to Greg's because it obviously has been in the news a lot. I mean, it's very popular with investors. They make the iconic sausage roll and coffees at very good prices. I guess the debate still is whether we've reached peak all things sausage roll. But what's your view? I mean, the shares definitely have come down and they're looking cheap. But is it a value trap or is it a value play?
It's still a very good business. I mean, this is a good high margin business, but highly successful. But the H1 results were poor, which is obviously why the share price has halved over the last year or whatever. So yeah, it's definitely got operation problems. Everyone's got their own pet theory about why Greg's is struggling a bit, but it's still a very, very good business, and we won't go into that. We've covered all that before, but I hold it personally. I think it's great value because they'll get the operational stuff back on track, I think. I think it's 13 times for what is really a quality business, I think is great value. Yeah, I like it. Are you interested in the shares of this?
You're right. It's absolutely 4% dividend yield, 12.5 times PE for a track record of a company that has been outstanding over the last. But I am getting a bit concerned in terms of their footprint and how much extra growth. And it was, I thought the last trading update was they had like-for-like sales growth of, what was it, about 2.5% or something, during a period when, frankly, the UK's got a lot of sort of like, you know, British tourists and overseas tourists and people travelling and all this sort of stuff. You'd have thought there'd be food on the go type sales would be pretty strong, actually. But I get it with the hot weather. The people, would they go for a coffee and will they go for a sausage roll? It just seems as though, yeah, it seems to be getting harder going forward to grow in this business. Which is why that's true.
Yes, I agree. It's not going to be, it's very unlikely it'll go back to a PE of 20 in the 20s, which it used to be on. But I think there's plenty of scope for it to recover earnings with just basic self-help stuff and move up from a PE of 12 to maybe a PE of 14. So I could see it being, I'm more a buyer at the current price than I'm not going to sell them.
The thing which would get me really interested would be suddenly if they decided, okay, we now have a partner to franchise the Greggs brand overseas, and we believe we can make a real. If they can repeat the UK success, which has been frankly phenomenal, anywhere overseas, then you get a totally different look on the business. It's a bit like McDonald's, you know, starts in the US and then gets transported, lifted, and shifted elsewhere, and becomes a world phenomenon.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Do they have any overseas stores at the moment? I don't know. I don't think they do. No, but that's a good point. I mean, certainly there'd be demand for them in Spain, wouldn't it, with all the Brits out there?
Even if you just put them in train stations or put them in airports, you know, around the world, because people, lots of British travellers anyway. Yeah. But
no, I think you're right.
Okay, let's go a bit further up the food chain. In industrials, we've got Ceres Power. Now, we hardly ever talk about this. This is a fuel cell company that was an absolute darling. It was sort of like in the same breath as ITM. Got bid up hugely during the lockdowns of the pandemic. Its technology helps convert green hydrogen into electricity, and it's signed a really big deal with a South Korean company, Doosan, to do. Effectively, they'll license their technology, their fuel cells, put them together, and then start selling that out for industrial applications, for data centers and stuff like this. I was just wondering whether you've any thoughts on this one at all. It seems to be it's obviously very popular with retail investors.
Yeah, we have been flagging it in our daily news reports because the news flow has been very good from Ceres Power. But the big and as you say, there was a lovely announcement in the last week, I think, where it said a major pivotal, development or something like that, that it flagged, saying that Doosan were commencing, I think, mass production or something like that, they said. But the big problem we've got on it is we've got no information, no financial information. And the existing forecasts are for continuing multi-million losses every year. So I've got nothing to go on in terms of how to value it. It has got a big cash pile remaining of about £100 million, but it's burning through it at a rate of knots. So totally impossible for me to value it, Paul. But the news flow has been very interesting for sure.
Yeah. There's a big company, if people want to look into the technology, there's a big one in the States. I think it's called Bloom Energy. And it's got a market cap of about $8 billion.
Is it really?
Yeah, compared to Ceres Power, which is about £250 million. So, you know, it's the opportunity. This market could be absolutely huge, but once it gets a path to profitability and people start seeing it generate cash, then you can get a better handle on whether it's going to be a success longer term, isn't it? Because it's difficult for me and you to gauge what the sort of competition's like, I believe. But
It's impossible. I mean, you know, that's why. I mean, I used to punt on things like this, but I don't anymore because fuel cells. I had a bad experience with a fuel cell company called Vola Energy. Years ago, and I fell for the story about how it was groundbreaking technology, and I lost a packet on it. So a bit of an investor's graveyard, fuel cell companies. And I have zero chance of being able to pick the winner in the sector, as you say. I think people need to be a bit careful jumping onto these stories. But I mean, look at the share price chart for people who jumped in at the bottom. It's been a lovely trade. People have made a bob or two, so it's nice to see. But
Good. Okay, well, let's just move to another sector. Let's go to another one in the REITs. We've got one reporting this week, which was Unite Group, which is the student purpose-built student accommodation throughout the UK. It's looking to buy, actually, or maybe looking to buy, Empiric Student as sort of like a synergistic smaller business. It basically, around the UK universities, Unite puts these purpose-built student accommodation, and they obviously, you know, good high spec.
Ticker. I need the ticker.
UTG. Trading at roughly around about 20-25% discount to net tangible assets. And we are now starting to see, amazingly enough, a return of international students into the UK, particularly from China, because they've now been, because of what happened with Trump, they're now turning their attention back to the UK to get to, because I don't want to go and learn out of, you know, basically English and the, you know, basically go to universities out in Trump. In fact, they can't get in. So they're coming more towards the UK. So you're seeing more international. And there's actually, just because of the league demographics, there's a tick up in the UK student numbers as well. Interesting anyway, but I just wonder if you've had a look at the sort of the student accommodation guys in the REIT. It's still, it's trading at a big discount to net tangible assets.
Yeah, no, I think we're very lucky to have all these foreign students coming into the UK because they pay substantial tuition fees, don't they? I think it's over 20 grand a year, and they're basically funding a large part of the UK tertiary education sector. So, yeah, I'm and Bournemouth's full of foreign students, and, you know, we're lucky to have them here, I think. But anyway, yeah, UTG, I haven't looked at it since, 8th of July. Has it had anything more recent than that? That was a Q2.
It came out with some numbers this week, actually.
I haven't updated my tickers, so I've not found that. We liked it when we last looked at it. The loan to value is quite low at 24%, which is a key number for REITs. As you say, discount to net tangible asset value is the other key number, which was about 20 odd percent. It was £8.07 when we looked at it. Do you know what it is now, Paul?
Yeah, it's £7.53.
Oh, so it's come down a bit. Yeah. What was the latest update then? Because that could be worth a look.
It was all in line. What they did say, though, was that they have been seeing across the whole industry people committing to accommodation to their vacancies slightly later than they did during the pandemic, which frankly is not a surprise, is it? Because, you know, it was you had to just lock yourself into certain accommodation when you were coming out of the pandemic. So you have been seeing longer, but they seem pretty comfortable with getting almost total, you know, basic, all utilization, sort of like only about 2% vacancy rates and 4-5% rental growth. And I think about the one exposure they do have is to Chinese students. I think there's about 15% of all of their rooms are taken by Chinese students. So there is an exposure. But clearly, if there's more Chinese coming in, they're going to do well.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. I mean, a lot of on my Substack, we love the REITs. I mean, there are so many bargains still around in the REIT sector generally. It's just time researching them, isn't it? They're quite time intensive to research. So I haven't, in all honesty, looked at Unite in any great depth, but it sounds like it should be on the list of quality, larger type REITs. The only thing is the consolidation tends to be at the low to middle level, doesn't it? Where some of these subscale REITs are being bid for. So Unite, maybe at 4 billion odd market cap, might be a bit too big to get a bid, possibly. But it does sound interesting.
KKR or Blackstone are all over this sector. So
That's true. Good idea. I like the sound of that.
Okay, let's just move to a little announcement by Facilities of ADF. We've talked about it before. Does the trailers which go into outside. They basically house the stars and the crews and stuff that go for outside broadcasters. So if you want to go and film a Harry Potter out in the Forest of Dean, for instance, they'll provide the trailers for that. They've had a number of different profit warnings. So this morning's news was that they're actually the CEO and founder has decided to step down immediately and been replaced by the exec chairman, a guy called Russell Down. The shares are off 10%. There was no trading updates. I just wondered how you viewed that, negatively or positively. Paul, can you hear me?
Oh, definitely negatively. I mean, oh, Hello. Yeah. Sorry, I was just loading up a web page. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah. Hello? Yeah. Yeah, I can hear you, Paul. I can hear you.
Sorry, I think a Google. Yeah, great. I think a Google document started hogging the bandwidth then, so I've closed the tab. Yeah. No, ADF, I'm pretty negative on. I think it was floated on the streaming boom of big TV production. Quite a cynical float, I think, with hindsight. And I think what you're seeing now of much worse performance from it is probably the new normal. Right. So I'm negative on it. There were also, I'll be careful what I say here because I don't want to set you off in panic mode. But I think there were definitely questions about the management. You know, they dumped a lot of stock in a placing, didn't they? And then there was a horrible profit warning just a few months later, you know. And Christopher Mills was very cross about that, I recall, in one of his broadcasts with you. So, no, I don't rate it at all. And the fact that now you've had a very unexpected departure of senior management tells you the things are not rosy there, doesn't it? So we think it should have dropped a lot more than 10% today. So, no, not one I would go near.
So you think the trading is worse, or is it actually just he had to go? Because I mean, that's really the nuts and bolts of it. Is sort of like the only bull case you would say is that they've cleaned out the management team, and they've put somebody new in to basically run the ship as it should be run. But the trading hasn't deteriorated, or do you think he's partly because of the actual trading has deteriorated just recently, which has led to him stepping down?
Well, I don't know, Paul. I would just be guessing. I didn't read this. My colleague Dave wrote a quick note on it in our report today. I mean, did it give any indication of the circumstances?
No, it didn't. No, I don't think he was thanked, and I don't think I think he was leaving immediately. So it was quite an abrupt departure, I think.
That's a big falling out, isn't it, when that happens? Yeah. But, we don't know why. But I would say it's unlikely to be good news in terms of trading and all the rest of it. Yeah. And maybe the shareholders, the big shareholders have just said enough is enough, because they've been let down in the past. But like you say, these type of situations, if you then, particularly with Harwood are all over this, if they parachute in someone really highly regarded, which is precisely what they did at Big Technologies, you got a 50% bounce in the share price, didn't you? So could go either way, Paul, couldn't it?
Yeah, no, you could do. Okay, good. We've got Richard Leppington. He's just asking about Trifast, the industrial fasteners business that actually Harwood were pretty upbeat about when I spoke to Nick Mills, who's the son of Christopher, on Monday as a turnaround.
They were raving about it, weren't they?
Yeah.
And I was really surprised at that because it's always looked to me such a boring and underperforming business. You know, it seems to always run into problems and have to do big, long-winded restructurings. They get the profits up and then, bang, another profit warning. You know, it's the history of it has really been poor. But my colleague Dave actually told me he'd done a lot more research on this. And he's looked into competitors and things like that and said, actually, this is fastenings. It's bespoke fastenings, isn't it, for all sorts of industries, particularly the automotive industry. He said it's actually quite a good market where you can make 10% operating margins if you're well managed. Yeah. And particularly, I think, with Harwood being so bullish on this in your interview with them, they were raving about it, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, yeah, yeah.
And it put about 9 or 10% on the share price that interview did. So, yeah, I'm tempted to buy some just to piggyback on the back of the Harwood guys. They make a very compelling case for it, even though I wouldn't normally be interested. If somebody makes a really well-researched, compelling case for you doubling your money, you wouldn't look in a gift horse in the mouth, would you? I think the balance sheet's okay. It passes my balance sheet testing, Trifast does. Yeah. Dave was saying that apparently they kind of have an attitude where they've got clients who've been with them for decades and they just agree to whatever the client asks for. So I think the management are having to try and change the mindset internally that, no, hang on, this is your target margin that you have to, so you have to tell the customer they've got to pay more. So it sounds like it's a bit of a culture change type of situation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. It wouldn't be something I'd normally go to, but if they've got visibility over increasing the margins, and I do understand how they get there, you know, it's to get to the, you know, the 10% from about 7.5% currently. And the way they're looking at it is, you know, they're focusing on where they make money, and those which they, the lower margin products they're shredding. So it's a shrink to grow model to get more profitable, to get to improve your return on capital employed, which is the hallmark of, you know, basically, you know, Harwood and Christopher Mills and also Richard Stavely. So, yeah, you can absolutely see how, you know, that that works. Another one on that one, which is worth just highlighting, because is Flowtech, because the Harwood Stable owned that one, which is, again, going through a turnaround. And what was quite interesting with Flowtech this last trading update was not the like-for-like figures, because I think sales were down 11%. But what was noticeable was the quality of the revenue stream had grown up, because gross had increased, because gross margins rose, and they did see sequentially from quarter one to quarter two an improving revenue stream, and also H1 from H2 last year was also improving. So I think they're doing the same strategy to increase margins and improve, you know, return on capital employed, which is shrink the top line, shed most of the loss making revenues, to then basically just grow the ones where you want, those areas that you're making most amount of money on, and concentrate on those for future investment. But I don't know what you thought on Flowtech.
Yeah, I've made a note of that phrase you used. I love this. I'm going to use this myself. Shrink to grow. That's fantastic. I love it. Did you make that up, or is that something you heard?
No. I'm sure I've heard it somewhere else, but I can't remember where.
But anyway, yeah, we did review this yesterday. Again, I think it was my colleague Dave who wrote up a section on it. We take on board the stuff they're doing to try and improve performance, but we didn't see enough evidence coming through in the numbers to get excited about it. And I think that's what the market is saying as well. So it's in a kind of, I think you call them show me type situations, yes, where the theory sounds great, but it's not yet actually delivering enough of a turnaround, if at all, really, for us to get excited about it. Balance sheet's a bit stretched, a bit too much debt on Flowtech. I don't think it's a crisis. I'm not, you know, ringing the alarm bell klaxons or whatever, but slightly uneasy with the debt. We'll wait and see on this one. But personally, I need to see more evidence before I'd probably have to pay 20 or 30% more for it. But, you know, it's not really the sort of, it's disappointing. It's been a very lackluster float from a few years ago. I think the previous management were ambitious to do acquisitions, but weren't very good at it, you know? Yeah. And then I think the new management have had to come in and sort out a bit of a mess. But they can't really do any more acquisitions because they haven't got any money, because the gearing's too high. It's a bit of a chicken and egg, and they don't want to issue equity because the equity's too cheap. So,
Well, it's interesting what you should say there, because they have actually done some acquisitions, but they bought one of their big competitors, Thorite, for out of almost bankruptcy for an asset purchase for about £2 million. And that added about £15 million of turnover to the top line. So if you take out somebody, your pricing improves, you get greater economies of scale on the same infrastructure, and you don't get all the legacy stuffs, and you just pick, you just cherry pick what comes off. So I think that was a really, really smart deal. I'm not racing in to purchase it, but I do think this and Trifast are quite interesting now, because once you start seeing sequential growth from quarter to quarter and from H2 to H1 in tough macro, then that's encouraging. But more importantly, when the margins are increasing on a lower turnover basis, that says to me, they're concentrating on what they can do well rather than doing everything. Because at some point, you've just got to basically say, 20 years of growth, organic and acquisitions, what isn't making me any money? And if I can't turn it around, I'm going to chuck it. And that's what they do.
But don't you think that's just the basics of running any business, isn't it?
When you go through a bunch of acquisitions in a company, you put a whole bunch together. How often do management teams fail to properly integrate, fail to rationalize their portfolio? I mean, it happens all the time, because they get stuck into this, your revenue's got to grow every single year, rather than actually cutting your weeds and watering your flowers, which is what they should be doing.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Highly acquisitive groups you know, look great for a few years, don't they? And then quite often the wheels just come off completely and you realize that they've just created a giant mess. And usually by that point, they've got a lousy geared up balance sheet as well. Generally, I'm not just talking about Flotek. So we'll keep a close eye on it. I do like these turnaround situations, but you know, I think sometimes the fund managers can be a bit blasé about them and just think, oh, it's just a question of getting margins up from 5% to 10%. Well, it's blooming difficult to actually achieve that in practice.
How often do we see a huge write-off of goodwill, which says no cash charge, but it totally decimates the balance sheet?
That's why we always write off goodwill for everybody.
Well, sometimes it's applicable, sometimes it's not. But certainly when it's all on air and it's all on brand, and then you don't integrate it, you don't get the synergies, then it's unsustainable at some point in time.
All right,
brilliant. Well, thanks everyone for your questions. Really fascinating as a session again. The next weeks will also be on Wednesday at 2 p.m. And thanks, of course, Paul. I love your glasses. And get back to strawberries and get back to strawberries and cream.
Yeah, that's right. Are we switching to Wednesdays now permanently, Paul?
We'll do Thursdays most of the time. But we can decide as we go along. But I can't do next Thursday.
Okay.
Brilliant. All right, thanks a lot then, guys. See you next week, 2 o'clock Wednesday.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.